How did I say this? I changed it a little bit from my notes. You guys have it written down? Can someone read off how I stated the postulate one?
Hunting, setting, preparation, device. Hunting described by a Hilbert space vector.
So we have a wave function psi that's an element of the Hilbert space H. And then we discussed some features of Hilbert space and infinite dimensional Hilbert space and separability. Let me give some examples of Hilbert spaces. So for finite dimensional systems, it's trivial, just a finite dimensional vector space, inner product space. In infinite dimensions, it's non-trivial. We have the space L squared of square summable sequences. So we let phi equal some sequence aj, where each aj is some complex number. And then the square summability refers to the fact that the Euclidean norm of the vector, which is aj complex conjugate aj, is finite. And j goes from 1 to infinity here. So this L squared space becomes a Hilbert space when we give it an inner product. So if we endow the space with an inner product, so here it's just a normed space, and then we give it an inner product, which would say denoted psi phi, which is equal to a sum over j, let's call it k, bk bar ak. And then it follows that this is going to be less than infinity by the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Where here I've defined a sequence psi with the set of coefficients bk. And then in Dirac notation, what this looks like is this. So in some mathematical fields, the inner product is switched. So this is the dual vector. Actually, I didn't mention dual vectors yet. Oh, right, I should probably mention that now, sorry. So backing up a second, I didn't mention the dual space last time, right? So when we have an inner product space, we have a dual space, which is called H dagger, which is dual to H. And this consists of all continuous linear functionals of the form F psi that takes some vector phi to C, where phi is an element of H. So F is a map. It takes as input a vector in the Hilbert space, and it gives as output a complex number. And it's a linear function of the input. Now, it turns out by Rietz's theorem, we know that the space of linear functionals, which do this, with continuous linear functionals, is in one-to-one correspondence with the vectors of the Hilbert space. So the elements of the dual with the elements of H. And so this enables Dirac notation to be so easy to work with. So then what we do is we can use as a notation F psi acting on phi is then equivalent to this notation psi phi. And we can talk about where the dual element associated with the vector psi is this. So this is a ket, and then we get the Bra vector by taking the dual of the ket. And this element, and this is an element of the dual space, which corresponds to some linear functional taking as input the vectors and returning complex numbers. So then when I was supposed to mention this before I gave the example here, because now what's going on in this example is that we have that psi then is an element of the dual space. So as a second example of Hilbert space, we have the space you learn about in wave mechanics. Okay, so all of wave mechanics is built on top of this structure. So in particular, we have the space L2R, which is a space of square integrable functions. Square integrable complex valued functions, satisfying where we can define a norm. So it's a normed space where we have some integration measure and we demand that with respect to this integration measure, it's the space of all functions, complex functions, such that this is true with respect to that integration measure. And then we can define an inner product of the form psi phi, which is again, so this can go. So L2R, so the fact that it's R means that we're integrating over the full real line. So implicit in this is that the limits of integration are plus and minus infinity. And then the inner product has the same form, except we have the complex conjugate, the dual space is complex conjugated, and then the vector space is not, and then this is, because this is true for psi and phi, which are elements of L2R, it follows that the inner product of any two such elements will be finite by the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality again. Okay, so this is by Cauchy-Schwarz. So for this space to be well-defined, I mean, there's a bit of a whole mathematical machinery that's implicit here to do with defining this integral, where it's defined as a Lebesgue measure. So just note, let me move this up. Is that high enough? So just as a remark, and we won't go into depth on Lebesgue measures, but for L2R to be well defined, we interpret integral over d mu x is, dot, 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 is a Lebesgue integral, which is defined in terms of measure theory. And we also assume that and functions that differ on sets of measure zero are considered equivalent. So this is just a little bit of mathematical bookkeeping. Functions that differ on sets of measure zero are equivalent. Okay, so by a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the dual space and the way it's been defined? All right, that's very easy. And then what about, how many of you have seen kind of the definition of a Lebesgue integral? About half of you? Okay, good. Good. It's not crucial for our purposes, so I won't be getting into it. So as a third example, and this is just the same pattern, I just want to note that we have the same structure where we can take a Hilbert space to be L2 over some finite interval. So this is relevant if you're thinking about an infinite square well potential in wave mechanics. Then the set of functions you have available to you are complex functions on some subinterval of the real line. So it's the same definition as above, except all of your integrals then go from A to B. And we can similarly define an infinite dimensional Hilbert space using this structure. So now, these are all Hilbert spaces. These are all separable. These are all separable Hilbert spaces, as we saw last class. Which means that every orthonormal basis is countable. And what's more, it turns out that all infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces are equivalent. So there really is only one infinite dimensional separable Hilbert space, and these are all different expressions of it, in a sense, in that there's the are all equivalent. What this means is between, say, these three examples, there's a bijective there exists a bijective structure preserving transformation mapping between them. So in other words, if we define the mapping between the elements in the new space will have the same inner products as the elements of the original space.
Question.
Yeah.
Is it not possible to make a Hilbert space like that has a bigger infinity, so to speak, than these guys, so that they won't be bijective?
To my knowledge, that's not possible. It would not be a separable Hilbert space. So you can have Hilbert spaces that are infinite dimensional, which are non-separable and have continuous bases. But these are structures that we don't need for quantum theory.
Okay.
So there are some advances, like people who work on, you know, unifying quantum mechanics with gravity, look at a broader set of mathematical structures, and then they consider these kinds of spaces. I'm not very familiar with them, but I know that that some of the people here work on this kind of thing. Mate, is that something that comes up in quantum gravity, the worrying about those kinds of spaces? No. Okay. So they exist mathematically, and they're explored physically in this people looking for a unified theory consider these kinds of things. Okay, so now we'll move on to measurement. Are there any other questions about any of this? No? So, okay, we're just recapping and kind of establishing a notation here. So a lot of this material will be familiar. So postulate two is that any setting, so we're skipping the transformation box for now and jumping right ahead to the measurement box. If you remember those three boxes I showed last class. And how to do this for postulate one? I said any setting of the measurement device, can be described again by a self-adjoint operator A. Which admits a spectral decomposition. I should just say with spectral decomposition A equal to a sum over L AL. Call it pi L. So I'm not consistent about putting hats on my linear operators. I hope it's clear from context. If not, please ask. And I'll try to, at least at the start, always put hats on operators. So this is a linear operator, of course. Such that, and here's where we get the two parts of this postulate. Postulate 2a is that there is a discrete set of outcomes labeled by the eigenvalues of the spectral decomposition. And notice these are labels rather than physical quantities. And 2b, the probability of observing outcome label for any L is given by Born's rule. Okay, how much do I have to unpack this? So how many of you are familiar with spectral decompositions? Awesome. How many are you familiar with the structure of projectors? Awesome. How many of you are comfortable with the trace? Amazing. Was this done in the preview course, or just you guys all have a great background?
Can you explain it for those of us who didn't raise our hands?
Oh, I thought I saw a unanimous. No problem. So, my apologies for that. So basically, the spectral decomposition piece. So basically, a spectral decomposition is possible for any self-adjoint operator. So all that means is that a spectral decomposition is available for any self-adjoint operator. It's actually more general than that. It's any normal operator. So later on, and you've all familiar with unitary operators, of course. So unitary operators are not self-adjoint, but they are normal, and therefore they admit a spectral decomposition. And we'll touch on that later. So the spectral decomposition is given above, where the set AL are real valued. And the set of projectors are projectors. So what that means is that they satisfy pi L pi K is equal to delta L K pi L. Now, in the case, Hilbert space is, slightly less familiar than, Cartesian vector spaces, right? So a projector is just this notion that if I have some, so as an example, in just good old R3, the 3 was a superscript, doesn't it? In R3, you have x, y, z, and then if you have some vector v, and you say I want to get the xy projector acting on V will just return the component of V in the xy plane. So it just picks off these two components. So you have V is equal to some AX EX plus AY EY plus AZ, EZ, and then VXY is just equal to AX, EX plus AY, EY. Where these hats are not operators, but this hat refers to the unit vectors. So it's a different meaning of hat here. Okay, so that's all a projector is. And in real space, you obviously all know what this is, but in a complex vector space, it's the same object, except it's projecting onto the vectors of the complex space, the basis vectors of the complex space. And this is an orthonormality condition. So we say the projector onto Z is orthogonal to the projector onto the XY plane. So if I get the null vector if I do them both in succession. Because now there's no, if I do this projector and then I act on this vector with the pi Z projector, then obviously I get the null vector because I've taken away all the components. So let's talk about some conceptual issues. The trace. So the trace is just the trace of any operator. Let me call it B. Just involves summing. You pick some orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space. you pick for any orthonormal basis. For H. And we can always think of L as a discrete index because we know we're dealing with separable Hilbert spaces. Okay? So that's the full unpacked mathematics. Conceptually, we have 2A, which is this labels issue. So does anyone know why I'm emphasizing that they're labels rather than observable values? This is something that's glossed over in textbooks. Yes?
I was explaining this to Kafir like a week ago, but the idea is that when you go and make a measurement in an experimental setup, for example, the things that you read off are almost irrelevant. Right? It depends on the device or the measurement that you're actually making. So whether or not you're measuring, like, you know, the mass of something, you might indirectly be looking at a voltage on an oscilloscope or something. And so you're just labeling all the possible outcomes of your measurement mm-hmm. as irrelevant.
That,
the value it takes on.
That's true. There's something else I'm fishing for, which is think about the physics of a system described by Hamiltonian. The absolute energy of a system is unmeasurable. It's really only differences in energy that are measurable. So so you can always add a constant to the, in classical and quantum physics, you can always add a constant to the Hamiltonian, and the physics is invariant under that. The physical predictions of the, both classical and quantum mechanics don't depend on adding that constant or not to the Hamiltonian. And so when we think about, like, one of the most canonical examples of an observable is the energy. And if we think about measuring the energy of the system, really all we're doing is, say, measuring which energy eigenstate it's in by a label. And what we actually observe, say, if we do the spectroscopy of the atom, like one of the earliest and oldest predictions of quantum theory, all you observe are the differences in energy between the different energy levels. And we can always add a constant to all of them, the differences remain the same. So the predictions of the theory in terms of the spectroscopy don't depend on the absolute value of the energy. So that's one of the reasons it's important to be careful. And one of the emphases of this class is really to strip away a lot of the baggage that comes with the normal way quantum mechanics is taught and say, well, what do we actually only really know about empirically about the theory? And let's be clear that this is what the theory predicts and not this extra stuff. So in this case, we really just have a set of labels. They can have units, but it's the differences in energy that matter, not the absolute values of energy. So that's the reason for being careful the way the 2A is stated. Yeah?
So if instead of decomposing it into energy states, you decompose it into angular momentum states, then you can't just say that you can add a constant to the angular momentum and then it doesn't matter, right? So what about in that case?
Okay, so convince me.
Yeah, that I can't just add a constant to the angular momentum.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, I mean you.
Spin faster, you know.
That's a good point. Let me punt on that and think about it. I mean, you do get. I mean, look, we get angular momentum from looking at the SU2 algebra, and there's a particular eigenvalue structure that pops out. And I'd have to think through, I don't know if I have to weaken this statement to be that the labels aren't necessarily observable, because there are definitely examples like the energy example where this is true. But whether there are exceptions to that rule is something I'd have to think through. So thanks for that question, and let me get back to you about that.
Sure.
So provisionally I would say that, you know, at least in some cases, the absolute value doesn't matter. It's just the differences that matter. And, you know, maybe angular momentum is an exception, but I doubt that's true, actually, because if you think about the Hamiltonian for the atom, you know, one of the terms you add in is this L times L plus 1 term from the angular momentum, orbital angular momentum. So it contributes to the energy. Okay, off the top of my head, I don't think I'll be able to figure this out. So let me think about it. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Does that, maybe one of you has tackled this question? Yeah.
I mean, I think it comes back to what I was just said earlier. Like, I think it's stronger than just adding a constant to your outcome labels or your eigenvalues. It's like any sort of one-to-one correspondence between two different sets of labels. If, like, you can go from one operator to the other, all that matters for your observation is the structure on your projectors or your eigenvectors of your operator. So for the case of the angular momentum, it's the same as saying the outcomes are labeled by these spin values or these angular momentum values, but you could redefine that label to be anything that you measure directly, for example. Like, you know, whether it's up or down is irrelevant, essentially. It's not the two, and all of the physics is the same. What you define, what your label defines is sort of something you can't measure, but it labels the projectors that you're using to calculate statistics.
Yeah, I like that comment about the up versus down labels was certainly a permutation of the labels. Yeah, so maybe there is some. All right, it's interesting. All right, we'll think about this. Thanks for the discussion. Point 2b here is that the probability of observing an outcome label AL is given by the Born rule. So this is the kind of famous statistical nature of quantum theory. Yeah?
Sorry, I didn't ask this fast enough. So why do we want to look at the projections of these vectors exactly?
What's the advantage? Let me answer the question. Right here, right? So how do we make predictions from the theory? Remember, quantum mechanics is predicting probabilities of outcomes, and that's kind of the best we can hope for. Because empirically, we find that for some settings of the devices, we don't get a deterministic response. So we know that we expect a mathematical model that's going to produce probabilities. And here we have the Born rule. Which you're probably familiar with. You've probably seen in undergrad quantum mechanics as something like, you know, the probability density is given by this function psi of x, absolute value squared, or norm squared. And then you have the what's the probability of finding the electron at a particular point? It's zero. You can only talk about, when you have a continuous label like this, you can only talk about probabilities over certain intervals. So the probability of finding x within some interval AB is equal to the integral from A to B of d mu x, where this can just be dx, psi of x squared.
What does that have to do with projecting a vector onto a space?
Nothing yet. So this is the way you're familiar with Born's rule. And we'll see later how this emerges as a subtle case because of the fact that we're dealing with in the case of the position x doesn't have an eigenbasis that is a basis of the Hilbert space. So in the case of a discrete observable, you have, for example, spin. So the probability of measuring some outcome of angular momentum, L, is equal to the trace of the projector onto the eigenstate L of the input state or the available state psi, which is, so here we recover the transition probability. The transition matrix element magnitude squared is the probability of finding the state in L. This is what you're familiar with from undergrad quantum mechanics. And so this is another way of writing this. Why are we writing it in this form in terms of projectors? What if I'm doing a measurement which doesn't care, which is measuring whether the system is going to be found in the eigenstate L or the eigenstate L prime? So it's simultaneously checking if whether one or the other of those outcomes you're checking if you're going to obtain that in the test, in the measurement setting. So let me give you this. So we can talk about the rank of the projector. The rank of a projector is the dimension of the Hilbert space on which a projector has eigenvalue 1. So note that for any projector the eigenvalues of the projector are always either 0 or 1. So that follows from the fact that we have this orthonormality relationship, and you can equivalently think of it in terms of the three-dimensional Euclidean example. So for this projector pi xy, what we're doing is we're projecting onto the two-dimensional plane in the three-dimensional real space. So that's a rank 2 projector. It has eigenvalue 1 on the x and y components and eigenvalue 0 on the z component. So the point of generalizing the Born rule to projectors is because we can describe higher projectors with rank greater than 1. So for example, we can write down the projector pi L is L. And we can write down another projector pi, which is two-dimensional, which is L plus L plus 1. So this has rank 2, and this has rank 1. And the relevance of this which I have an example of here. Let me pull it out. So consider a Hilbert space C3. So this is a finite dimensional Hilbert space. It's a three-dimensional complex vector space. And then we can label a basis as 0, 1, 2 for this three-dimensional Hilbert space. And then I can define a projector onto 1, 2. Here, 0, 1, and 2 are exactly like x, y, z. So the projector, so then I can write, so any vector psi, which is an element of C3, can always be decomposed as some linear combination of the form sum over L CL L, which would be C01 plus C02 plus C00 plus C11 plus C22. And then if we take this vector and we act on it with the projector, this projector has eigenvalue 1 on the subspace 1, 2, and it has eigenvalue 0 on the subspace 0. So what it will return is, as output, C1, 1, plus C2, 2. So it kills off the component of the input vector, so psi is the input vector, it kills off the component along the zero vector, the vector labeled 0, just like we had in three-dimensional space. And this corresponds to doing the following measurement. So a real vector in the three-dimensional space, we think of that as being the position of a particle. A quantum state psi in a three-dimensional space does not refer to the position of a particle. It refers to a preparation procedure over a three-dimensional Hilbert space. And when we talk about projecting onto a subspace such as the 1-2 subspace, what we're looking at is the probability that we will find the particle in either the 1 state or the 2 state. And that follows from Born's rule. So the probability of finding the particle in the 1 or the 2 state is equal to the trace of pi 1-2 psi psi. Are all of you comfortable with me writing these outer products? Is anyone not comfortable with it? Because the reason for doing this, well, I was going to get to it. I'll get to it, and it's coming. I'll mention it in the right moment. Okay, so an interesting anecdote about this is that when you know they were formulating quantum mechanics in the 20s and 30s, they had Schrodinger's equation, and they had the Heisenberg's matrix formulation of quantum mechanics, but it wasn't crystal clear how to relate that formalism to empirical facts, and it was Born, of course, that proposed the Born rule. To say, oh, given some wave function, how do we connect that with experimental results? And it's via this rule that predicts probabilities of different outcomes. But when he actually wrote the paper, he originally wrote instead of writing it as absolute value of psi of x squared, he actually had it as just psi of x. And then there's a note in proof in the paper that it was actually psi of x absolute value squared inside the integral. So it's a pretty basic mistake, but it was caught before final publication. Okay, we have to move over here. Okay, so now we're on to postulate 3, which is our last postulate. Any setting of the transformation device can be described by unitary operator U satisfying . So this is a variant of the Schrodinger equation written in directly in terms of the unitary. Where H is a self-adjoint operator, which is the energy function. is the time parameter. I hadn't thought about this till this moment, and I think that you can think about the T1 and T2 here as being parameters on the setting of the device. With initial condition, so if T2 equals T1, we just have the identity operator. And such that psi at T2 is equal to U of T2 T1 psi of T1. So I mentioned earlier that when we quantum theory is a dynamical theory, it has certain structural features to it in terms of what kind of mathematical structures we need, such as Hilbert space and self-adjoint operators to describe systems. But we need additional input to make predictions. And so in this case, we need the additional input is a specification of the energy function, which comes from the fundamental forces at play. So, electromagnetic theory, strong, weak force, standard model, that goes into H, or more precisely, a Lagrangian in the relativistic setting. Also, when it comes to measurements, I described this abstract model of how measurements work, but we don't provide a prescription of how to find the appropriate operator that's assigned to some setting. And here we don't know the appropriate operator H that's assigned to some setting of the device. And similarly, when it comes to state preparation, we don't know which vector psi to assign. So quantum mechanics just tells us there are these elements. There is the vector psi, there is the self-adjoint operator A, and there is the unitary operator U, or the Hamiltonian operator H. But the way in which you determine which operators to use for which settings of the devices or which physical situation you're describing depends on your knowledge of the physics of the problem, the forces at play in the problem, whether those are fundamental forces or effective forces. So we take these three postulates, we supplement them with other knowledge, and together they make predictions that we can compare to experiment. So additional mathematical remarks is that the nature of this differential equation implies that U dagger U is equal to U U dagger is equal to identity. So this means that U is unitary. So a unitary operator is a normal operator, so therefore it emits a spectral decomposition. We have that in general, the solution, you've all seen this in undergrad quantum mechanics, we can write a time-ordered exponential, so I'm just including this for completeness. So this is the general solution. And then if H is time independent, then you just have U over some time T, which is the difference between T1 and T2, which is equal to the familiar form you've seen. So from postulate 3, we can also directly deduce the Schrodinger equation. In the more familiar format. And then you know we have the Heisenberg picture. Which says that the observables have time dependence. And the states do not. And I think this should be T2. But I have to check. And then you can write down the equation of motion. But here, the point here is this is this T2 and T1 here are the time evolution under the Hamiltonian. And we have an additional time dependence to the operator if it's some kind of effective operator. So if we're describing things in a rotating reference frame or something like that, we get an acquired time dependence to A, which is an intrinsic time dependence. And then this is the extrinsic time dependence due to the dynamics. And I think this is supposed to be a 2 on this, but I'd have to check. And then you can write down a differential equation for the, in general, time-dependent operator and the... In the Heisenberg picture. So the subscript H refers to the Heisenberg picture, and it's given by the commutator. And then we have this extra term here due to the intrinsic time dependence. And the subscript H here means it acquires, if you write this out explicitly, it actually includes these unitaries in its description. So this is the postulate 3 in the Heisenberg picture. And this is postulate 3 in the Schrodinger picture. Okay, so that covers the kind of basics, what I would consider to be more or less a full description of the postulates of quantum mechanics. But of course, there's a lot to unpack here. Maybe I'll go a little bit further before taking a break. So the next thing I want to tell you about is moving towards just an explanation as to why I'm using these outer products so much. And so let me introduce it this way. So we'll talk about it dynamically. We have the von Neumann equation, which I think there's only one M, but two N's in von Neumann. So recall that we have a gauge freedom in quantum theory. So any vector psi, I can multiply by an arbitrary phase factor, and we'll call this psi prime. And this is not physically observable. So this is a global phase. Okay, why? Well, because if I have the probability of some outcome AL, so I have some observable, the probability of the outcome AL is equal to the trace, well, it's equal to psi pi L psi, which we can also write as the trace of pi L psi psi, and this is equal to psi prime pi L psi prime, because we just get e to the I phi and e to the minus I phi times psi pi L psi. And these obviously just give us one. So the point is, when we write it this way, then when we're just talking about the state, we can use the notation of a density operator, which we'll define this as rho psi is equal to this outer product psi psi. So this is called an outer product. Outer product formed from the vector psi. You'll notice that as shorthand, instead of writing this like this, I just make kind of a giant X, right? So it just, hope it's clear that I just mean this when I do that, which is easier to write. And of course, in this case, this is a rank one projector. So we can describe the pure quantum states of wave mechanics as these projectors. And in this way, this is invariant under that transformation. So under the gauge, so notice that psi and psi prime equal to e to the I phi psi are different vectors in H that are physically equivalent. But rho psi and rho psi prime are the same projector, are mathematically the same. So by going into this representation of states as projectors, we aren't sensitive to this mathematical freedom anymore. It's disappeared from our representation. Yeah?
Can you move that board so we can see what was under it? Because I didn't quite finish copying it. Oh. The one that you were just writing on.
Yeah, sorry about that. That was the rear one. So let me put it all the way up. Did that? That didn't.
I think it's under the.
Oh, I see. Yeah. There we go. You probably still can't see it very well. So the advantage of working with these projectors is that we have a mathematical representation which kind of respects the physical equivalence of these two different vectors. And then when we're working in this in terms of a density operator, then we can talk about postulate 3 in the von Neumann representation, well, it's called the von Neumann equation. Let me call it as the von Neumann equation. Has the form d rho t, I'm just going to drop the subscript psi now, by dt is equal to 1 over ih bar h of t rho of t. And now the point here is now rho, which is, represents the quantum state, is now an operator. So now the quantum state, instead of it being a vector in a Hilbert space, is an operator that acts on the Hilbert space. So the quantum state rho is now a linear operator that acts on the Hilbert space rather than a vector in H. And of course, there's something very beautiful about this picture, which is, and one of the things you'll get out a lot out of me this over the next coming weeks is the kind of striking parallels between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics that occur when you look at quantum mechanics the right way. A lot of the quantum mechanical machinery is kind of new and mathematically new and unfamiliar, but it turns out it's just classical mechanics in disguise in a format you haven't seen before. And so it's important to understand kind of what's innovative about quantum theory. We need to understand what aspects of it are actually just classical theory in a different mathematical framework. And so we know that we have classical Liouville dynamics. The classical dynamics of a probability density, which is called the Liouville dynamics. So I have some classical mechanical system governed by some Hamiltonian, and then I are Newton's laws, if you really want to go back some centuries. And then Liouville, back in the 19th century, pre-quantum mechanics, said, well, look, suppose I, instead of describing the actual location in phase space of my cannonball, let me assume that I don't have perfect knowledge of the cannonball. Instead of describing the cannonball's exact position and momentum, let me describe my actual knowledge, which is some probability density or some probability distribution of the possible positions and velocities of the cannonball that are consistent with the knowledge that I have, because I always have finite precision in any measurement, even classically. Quantum mechanically, there's a fundamental limit to your precision. Classically, there's no fundamental limit, but there's always a practical limit. You can never measure anything to infinite precision. So it's always the case that you go from talking about the coordinates of a particle, and here by particle I mean, you know, planet or cannonball, which will be referred to as, these are phase space coordinates. So the phase space coordinates of some object is going to be an x and a p. And this refers to some point in phase space. So this is one particle in one dimension, has an x and a p coordinate. But now instead of talking about that, I can instead talk about a probability density in that space. So I would have instead some mean value associated with some probability density function. So I'm, you know, with very, so think of this as coming, circles denote probability height coming out of the board. So the inner circle is, here I'm very confident the particle is within this region, but it might also be in this outer circle. You can imagine this as some kind of like, you know, Gaussian. some kind of Gaussian probability density if you project. Is this clear what I'm illustrating? A probability distribution? Like imagine kind of like a mountain or a hill coming out of the plane. Right, and then we associate this, and then there's a mean value, and we can refer to this as a probability density of where the particle is in phase space at some time. So at time t equals 20 seconds, I think the object is right here, and here's my probabilistic description of where it is. So Liouville asked in, I think it was 1895, he said, if I know that every trajectory, every point inside this density is described by the laws of Hamilton's equations, how do I describe, how does my knowledge as a whole evolve in time if every underlying point is following Hamilton's equations of motion? And then he derived, so from Hamilton's equations of motion, for each point, which is a possible location, location in phase space, xp, then you get the following. You get a Poisson bracket, which is a generalization of the commutator. This is a Poisson bracket. How many of you are familiar with Poisson brackets? Wow, how did that happen? Where did you learn about it?
Front end.
I'm sorry?
In the front end classes.
Oh, the front end. Okay, great. This is great. Okay, so you know about Poisson brackets. You know that they basically, it's like a Lie bracket with some additional structure. And then you know that it's equal to 1. And so the kind of Dirac quantization procedure is to elevate this to a commutator and add in IH bar. Did you also see how the Poisson bracket can be defined by these very basic properties, like what are they? What are the conditions that define a Poisson bracket? It's Leibniz's law, and a whole list is like 4 of them. Antisymmetry and all these things. So then you say, well, if I assume that the underlying variables x and p, this Poisson algebra, if you assume it's a non-commutative algebra, then you get that the representation of the Poisson bracket is for a commutative algebra, this Poisson bracket admits a representation as dH by dQ, d rho by dP. I'm calling it X actually. Minus d rho by dX. dH by dP. Have you seen that? That's really neat. So if you assume the underlying algebra is commutative, you get Hamilton's equations of motion. How do you get Hamilton's equations of motion? You know that, well, there's a way to derive it. You get Hamilton's equations of motion. I won't go through the derivation. And then if you assume you have a, for a non-commutative algebra, you guys haven't seen this, right? Have you seen this? For a non-commutative algebra, then there exists a unique representation of the Poisson bracket. Which is the Poisson bracket of any two operators, AB, is proportional to the commutator. So there's this beautiful perspective on quantum mechanics, which is you start from the von Neumann equation, where I wrote here. You start with the von Neumann equation, you start with the Liouville equation expressed in this abstract form as a postulate. And then you say, okay, well, I have some Poisson bracket with some Poisson algebra over some variables x and p, which you can generalize to three dimensions and multiple particles. And then you say, now I assume that algebra is commutative, and I get classical physics. If I assume the algebra is non-commutative, then I get quantum theory up to some unknown constant, which ends up being measured empirically to be h bar, which is this proportionality. And somehow you have to throw an I in there for everything to make sense. So I think that's a really neat perspective. It'd be nice to actually reduce this to some physical postulates. In other words, to deduce the non-commutativity from some operational assumption about sequential measurements or something like that. I've never seen that done. But it's a very nice way to see how you get this kind of abstract formulation of a dynamical theory, and then you get this bifurcation where this one physical assumption about commutativity gives you either quantum mechanics or classical mechanics. Yes?
Sorry, I might be misremembering this, but shouldn't we have a complete derivative instead of a partial time derivative?
No, that's important. So it turns out that the full derivative is equal to zero.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, this has to do with thinking through, like, you know, flow of a non-compressible fluid and things like that, which I always have to think through really carefully to get right. But it's actually from this assumption that you derive this equation. What you do is you do essentially a chain rule. I've done this 1,000 times, and I forget how it goes, but you do some kind of chain rule argument, and then you take advantage of the fact that what pops out, so you apply the chain rule by evaluating this derivative, and then you get something like this,
and Hamilton's equations.
Well, you can either use Hamilton's equations or you can derive Hamilton's equations. It depends what your starting point is, but the key point is to realize that when you do the chain rule, you realize that, well, dp by dt is actually dh by dq minus dh by dq, and dq by dt is actually minus dh by dp. And so basically, you either assume this and you can derive, I can't remember the exact way it works, or you just start by assuming nothing and you obtain Hamilton's equations of motions out, just by applying just mathematical rules of calculus. You start with this assumption. You get this representation of the Poisson bracket. And then you compare it with the chain rule from the time derivative. And then you get the identification that these relations must hold. I think that's how it works.